Most of the men were wearing Israeli-style para boots with a zigzagging patterned sole, and those coming up from behind had overtrodden the spoor of the leaders. He had to go down on one knee to examine the signs minutely before he could pick out the imprint of a much smaller and more delicately formed foot, a lighter, unmistakably feminine tread. It was partially obliterated by other larger masculine footprints, but the outline of the toe was clear, and the pattern was that of a smooth, rubber-soled Bata tennis shoe. He would have recognised it from 10,000 others. He was relieved to find that Tessé was still with the group, and that she had her lover and not left and taken another path. Mecnima was a sly one and cunning. He had escaped from Boris's clutches once before, but not this time. The Russian shook his head vehemently. Nah, not this time. He gave his full attention to the female footprint once again. It gave him a pang to look at it. His anger returned in full force. He did not consider his feelings for the woman. Love and desire did not enter into the equation. She was his chattel, and she had been stolen from him. It was only the insult that had significance for him. She had rejected and humiliated him, and for that she was going to die. He felt the old thrill run through his blood at the thought of the kill. Killing had always been his trade and his vocation, but no matter how often he exercised his craft, the thrill was never blunted, the pleasure never satiated. Perhaps it was the only true pleasure left to him, pure and unjaded. Not even the vodka could weaken and dilute it, as it had the physical act of copulation. He would enjoy killing her even more than he had once enjoyed coupling with her. These past few years he had hunted only the lower animals, but he had never forgotten what it was like to hunt down and to kill a human being, more especially a woman. He wanted Mecnima, but he wanted the woman more. In the days of President Mengistu, when he had been head of the counterintelligence, his men had known his tastes and had picked the pretty ones for him. He had only one regret now, and that was that this time he would have to do it swiftly. There would be no question of drawing it out and savouring the pleasure, not like some of the other experiences, which had lasted for hours, sometimes for days. "Bitch," he mouthed, and kicked at the dust, stamping on the faint outline of her footprint, obliterating it, just as he would do to her. "Black fornicating bitch." He ran now with fresh strength and determination as he left the trail and climbed up towards the deformed tree and the beginning of the goat track up the cliff. Exactly where he expected it, he found the start of the track and followed it upwards. The higher he climbed, the steeper it became. Often he had to use both hands to haul himself up a gradient, or to work his way along a narrow traverse. The first time he had climbed this mountain, he had been following the blood spoor of the wounded ibex. But now he did not have those splattered droplets to guide him, and twice he missed the path and found himself in a dead end on the cliff face. He was forced to edge back from the drop and retrace his footsteps until he found the correct turning. Each time he did so, he was aware that he was losing time, and that Mecnima might pass before he was able to intercept him. Once he startled a small troop of wild goats, which were lying on a ledge halfway up the cliff. They went bounding away up the rock face, more like birds than animals, bound by the laws of gravity. They were led by a huge male with a streaming beard and long spiral horns, which in its flight showed Boris a direct route to the top of the cliff. He tore the skin off his fingertips, dragging himself up the last steep pitch, but finally he reached the top and wormed his way over the skyline, never lifting his head. A human form silhouetted against the clear, eggshell blue sky would be visible from miles around. He moved along behind the crest until he found a small clump of sansevieria to give him cover, and used the erect, spiny leaves to break up the outline of his head as he surveyed the valley 1,000 feet below through the binoculars. From this height, the Nile was a broad, glittering serpent uncoiling into the first bend of the Oxbow, its surface ruffled by rapids and rocky reefs. The high ground on either bank formed standing waves of upthrust basalt, turbulent and chopped into confusion like a storm sea in a tropical typhoon. The whole danced and shimmered in the heat, and the sun beat down with the blows of an executioner's axe, pounding this universe of red rock into heat-exhausted submission. Though the air danced and trembled with the mirage in the lenses of his binoculars, Boris traced out the rough trail beside the river and followed it down the valley to the point where it was hidden by the bend. It was deserted, with no sign of human presence, and he knew that his quarry had moved on out of sight. He had no way of telling how far down the trail that they had travelled. He knew only that he must hurry on if he were to cut them off on the far side of the mountain. For the first time since he had left the river, he drank sparingly from the water bottle. He realized how the heat and the exertion of the climb had dehydrated him. In these conditions, a man without water might be dead in hours. It was not in the least surprising that there was so little permanent human habitation down here in the gorge. When he backed off the skyline, he felt rejuvenated and set out to cross the saddle of the mountain. It was less than a mile across, and without warning he came out onto the top of the cliffs on the far side. One more unwary pace and he would have stepped off into space and plunged down 1,000 feet. Once again he moved along the crest until he found a concealed vantage point from which to spy the terrain below. The river was the same, a wide and confused expanse of white-ruffled rapids running back towards him as it turned through the leg of the Oxbow. The trail followed the near bank, except where it was forced to detour inland by the rugged bluffs and stone needles which rose out of the Nile waters. In the great desolation of the gorge, he could pick out no movement other than the run of wild waters and the ceaseless dance of the heat mirage. He knew it was not possible that McNamara had moved fast enough to have passed completely ahead of him. Therefore, he must still be coming around the bend of the Oxbow. Boris drank again and rested for almost half an hour. At the end of that time, he felt strong and fully recovered. He debated with himself whether to descend immediately and stake out an ambush on the trail, but in the end decided to keep to the high ground until he had his quarry in sight. He checked his rifle carefully, making sure that the telescopic sight had not been bumped out of alignment during the climb, and then emptied the magazine and examined the 5 cartridges. The brass case of one of them was dented and discoloured, so he discarded it and reloaded with another from his belt. He chambered around and set the safety catch. He set the weapon aside while he changed his sweat-dampened socks with a fresh dry pair from his pack and retied his bootlaces with care. Only a novice would risk blistered feet in these conditions, for within hours they would be infected and festering. He drank once more, and then stood up and slung the .30-06 on his shoulder, ready now for anything that the goddess of the chase could send his way. He moved off along the crest to intercept the war party. From every vantage point along the rim, he glassed the valley below, each time without spying his quarry, and the afternoon passed swiftly. He was just beginning to worry that McNamara had somehow managed to slip past him unseen, that he had crossed the river at some secret ford, or taken another path through a hidden valley, when there came a plaintive and querulous cry on the heat-hushed air. He looked up. A pair of kites were circling over one particular clump of thorn scrub on the river bank. A yellow-billed kite is one of the most ubiquitous scavengers in Africa. It exists in close symbiotic association with man, feeding off his rubbish, picking up his leavings, soaring and circling over his villages or his temporary campsites, watching for his scraps or waiting patiently for him to squat in the bushes and then dropping down immediately he has finished his private business, acting as a universal sewage disposal agent. Boris studied this pair of birds through his binoculars, as they sailed idly in the heated air, always circling directly over that same patch of riverine bush. They had a distinctive manner of steering with their long, bifurcated tails, twisting them from side to side as they flirted with the breeze. Their bright yellow beaks showed clearly as they turned their heads to look down at something in the scrub. He smiled coldly to himself. Da! Nimer has gone into camp early. Perhaps the heat and the pace are too fierce for his new woman, or perhaps he has stopped to play with her a little. He moved on along the rim until he could look down directly into the patch of bush. He studied it through the binoculars. but without picking out any signs of human presence. After almost 2 hours, he was becoming uncertain of his original assumption. The only thing that retained his attention was the pair of kites, which had settled in a treetop overlooking the patch of scrub. He had to trust that they were watching the men hidden in the scrub. He glanced at the sun anxiously. It was sliding down towards the horizon at last, and losing its furious heat. Then he looked down into the valley again. Directly below the patch of bush was an indentation in the river bank that formed a backwater, almost a small lagoon. When the river was in flood, it would be inundated, but now there was a small strip of gravel bank exposed. On this bank stood a number of boulders that had tumbled down from the cliff above. Some of them were lying on the beach, while others had rolled into the river and were half submerged. The largest was the size of a cottage, a great round mass of dark rock. As he watched, a man emerged unexpectedly from the scrub. Boris's pulse quickened as he watched him scramble down onto one of the smaller boulders and jump from there onto the gravel bank. He knelt at the water's edge and filled a canvas bucket with water, then climbed back and disappeared into the bush again. "Aha, the heat is too much, even for them. They must drink, and that gives them away. If it had not been for the birds, I would never have known that they were there." He clucked softly with reluctant admiration. "Ha ha! Nimer is a careful man. No wonder he has survived so long. He keeps tight control. But even he must have water." Boris kept watching through the glasses as he tried to guess what Mac Nimer would do next. "He has lost much time here by sheltering from the heat. He will march again as soon as it is cooler. He will make a night march," he decided, as he looked at the sun again. 3 hours until dark. I must make my move before then. Once it is dark, it will be difficult to pick my targets. Before he stood up, he wriggled back from the skyline. He retraced his steps back along the mountainside until a bluff shielded him from the eyes of MacNimmer's sentries. Then he started down. There was no goat track here, and he had to make his own going, but after a few false starts he discovered an inclined rock shelf that afforded him a fairly easy path down the face. When he reached the bottom of the gorge, he took careful stock of the lie and run of the stratum, so as to be able to find it again in an emergency. It was a good escape route, and he knew that he might soon be under pursuit and duress. It had taken him over an hour to negotiate the descent, and he knew that he was running out of time. He reached the trail at the water's edge and started back along it towards MacNimmer's camp. He was in a hurry now, but even then he was careful to take anti-tracking precautions. He walked on the edge of the trail, stepping only on the stony ground, careful to leave no sign of his passing, but despite his caution, he nearly walked right into them. He had not covered the first 200 meters, when in the back of his mind he registered the low, mournful whistle of a pale-winged starling and almost ignored it until alarm bells sounded in his mind. The timing was all wrong. The starling only gave that particular call at dawn, when it left its nesting site high up in the cliffs. This was late afternoon, down in the heated depths of the gorge. He guessed that it was a signal from one of the scouts coming up the trail towards him. MacNimmer's party was on the move. Boris reacted instantly. He slipped off the trail and ran back the way he had come until he reached the beginning of the pathway along which he had descended the cliff. He climbed just high enough to be able to overlook the trail. However, he realized that he had lost much of the advantage that he had built up by cutting across the mountain. This was not the ideal ambush position, and his escape route was exposed to enemy fire from below. He'd be lucky to make it to the top, but the idea of abandoning his vengeance never occurred to him. As soon as his targets were in his sights, he would shoot from this stance.